Hello, everybody. This is Eduardo Chama, and I am here with my friend and starred opera singer Jean Rillier.
Hello.
Hello. Two bass baritones talking.
Yes.
And I will pass some of your questions, but before I start, thank you very much for doing this for the students of Rutgers University. And I always ask everybody the kind of the same question at the beginning. I know that your parents were singers, are singers, mm-hmm. and you know, teachers, and probably that's one of the reasons you started the opera in your house. But how did you start liking opera? Why? What at what age? What happened?
It's funny because I, you know, grew up with singing around the house, and so as a child, you know, and into my early teens, it was kind of a something that was really kind of mundane to me in a way. I didn't really think much about it because it was like my parents' work, you know. So I didn't really kind of get the whole picture of it until later on. I'd been playing guitar and playing rock and roll and all this, and I always knew that I would go into music. But there was a point one day where my father, he heard me talking or humming something or whatever, and he knew that there was a voice in there, and he said, "Why don't you try singing a few notes?" And I did, and it was interesting because I think I had his sound in my ear for so long that some part of me instinctively understood sort of the voice production on a basic level, and I was kind of surprised because there was this pretty good sized voice in there that I had no idea about until that day. So it kind of I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it might even be cathartic when you find your voice, when you realize you have a voice, and suddenly you're channeling your emotions through this other form of self expression. And that sensation, that feeling, kind of grew and grew the more I found my voice. And I ended up in opera kind of a little bit later on. I did a lot of concert work at first.
In classic concert?
Yeah, a lot of oratorio. A lot of oratorio, a little bit of recital. But I started sort of learning the repertoire with my father, who had really, his career had been more balanced towards that, to aid him being close to the family more of the time. So he would do concert work and be gone for less time. So this was a repertoire that I heard a lot growing up, and a lot of the melodies were still familiar with me. And I started doing that. I started auditioning for things at 20 and 21 and started doing work with symphony orchestras in Canada. Meanwhile, I was learning a little bit of opera arias and such. But I'd say about 2 years later, when I was working on some opera roles. I did a part in Magic Flute, just a second-armed man or something, but I started to really understand that and feel that the appeal for doing opera was the theatrical side as well. And I that was another component, another dimension beyond just doing concert repertoire, of course, where you were really emphasizing text, but the drama and the idea of the drama with the music was what kind of really lit the spark for me. And so I went down to Curtis and started going to school there and got acting training, which we can talk about more later. Around that time, you know, when I was doing staged scenes and that sort of thing, I suddenly realized this was such a great outlet.
Do you remember what age you were?
At that point, about 22.
22. So you started
Curtis was 21, and then I was there until 95, or sorry, 96.
Shh, don't tell your age. They can calculate it. What about the first opera that you saw, not that you participated?
Oh. Yeah.
Do you remember what it was?
My earliest memory of this being seeing my father in an opera was Queen of Spades, and I was only 6 or 7 at the time, and it scared the crap out of me. But it was amazing theater, you know. I think Judith Forst was in that. Alan Monk, I think, was in it. But some really great singers, and at the time, Fantastic staging, and I saw a production that, this was actually during a summer festival that they were having in Ottawa. They used to have really great budgets for that, and they would do three or four operas, very, very fully staged, big productions, and during the summer, which I think were toured by the Canadian Opera Company. And I saw a production of Queen of Spades and also Bohème. My father was singing Marcello in that. And also Midsummer Night's Dream, which was directed by John Copley.
Oh, wow.
It was fantastic. It was just great. So I got some very, very contrasting dramatic themes in those operas, and they really stuck with me. And so those were kind of eye-opening experiences, really.
And you were born in Canada, so you're Canadian, although you live in America.
My parents were from the States originally. So I had dual citizenship.
Yeah, which was like everybody else. International.
Yes.
Not so good.
I'm a North American.
Not so good for taxes, but, but it's very good. And you have a family, which your wife is a violist, and you have two kids that I hear just already playing the cello and the piano. Yeah. So there is a lot of music.
Yeah, we're trying to be like the Von Trapps or something.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your career. You said you studied in Curtis. You finished Curtis? You didn't finish Curtis?
I was almost finished Curtis, but really what happened was the opportunity came to... I did the Marilla the second summer that I was at Curtis. I got into the Marilla that summer. It was 95. And that led to an offer to do the Adler Fellowship Program with their Young Artist Program. And I really had to take that opportunity and just go to that.
Can you tell about the Young Artist, because they probably don't know what it is.
Starting with the Marilla Opera Program, it's a 10-week program which starts in June, goes through August. And... you get to do master classes with, say, two or three different, renowned singers. I think at the time I worked with Régine Crespin, I'm getting a little confused, but it was her. And and also you work very, very hard on different. We did a semi-stage production, which was La Perico by Offenbach, which really wasn't much for me in that. Then we did Marriage of Figaro, there was just a lot of rehearsing, master classes, coachings, and stuff going on during the week. So it's a real exercise in learning what your limitations are, your capabilities. You find new strengths. Work on a lot of the challenges with. I think they had about three different coaches, and then we three apprentice coaches that we would work with, but also with coaches from the actual opera company. So we picked up a lot. There's a lot of training in a 10-week period, and it was a very big growth in a short period of time.
And by that time, you were studying first with your father. Then, when you were in Curtis, you studied with.
I worked with Edward Zambara,
who's
passed away since. He was kind of a good teacher of sort of bel canto style, but my father was my first teacher.
Your first teacher, and then when you went to Merola, you were without teacher, basically. You started.
Yeah, the tricky part in San Francisco is that there really are very, very few voice teachers. I mean, at least at the level that I was looking for at the time. That's changed a bit now. There are some really good teachers over at the conservatory, but I was really on my own from like 96 through 98. And in 98, which was my... the end of my second year as an apprentice. It's typically a two-year program. We can talk more about what that program is, the Adler program. But that was about the time that I hooked up with Jerome Hines. I came upon his book that was published that year called Four Voices of Man, which was a very comprehensive breakdown of vocal technique, particularly concerning male voices. And that book really, it was my language. It was the way I thought about singing when I read it. I could understand his ideas, and I thought I need to get a hold of him and work through this theory with him. And it came at a very good time because his technique is very good at finding the full core of your voice, and that was what I was ready to do at that particular time in my development. And I, with the Adler program, I was doing like 3 productions simultaneously at any given time of the season. So I was on stage 3 or 4 nights a week.
So basically, let's come back a little bit to the Adler program. So in the Adler program, which is in San Francisco and is part of the San Francisco Opera Company, they give you like a full scholarship, so you're able to leave.
You're completely taken care of for your you get a salary, and it's a livable one, and in my case, I was the only bass in the program, so I got a lot of small roles on stage, and at Lakfi Mansouri, who was a general director at the time, was a fantastic proponent of championing young artists, upcoming artists, so he even gave me a Figaro at the end of my fellowship, but the greatest part of it was really just being able to be on stage
all the time.
And doing very different roles.
And during the day or during the week, you were teachless for that period, kind of, but you do have classes, coaches.
Yeah, and I would oftentimes talk to a lot of the people coming through performing. A lot of the stars get their ideas on certain elements of technique that I felt I wanted to develop more, or obstacles that I needed to get around.
Which is okay. And it's something that I tell my students all the time. Mm. If you get to work with colleagues and you like what they do, just ask.
Yeah, just ask.
At my maximum, they will say no.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But if they tell you and they give you a tip, how do you breathe? How do you do this? Can you walk and maintain the sound?
Exactly.
These are good ideas.
Yeah.
Now, after the Adler, then you were you moved to the East Coast, correct?
Yeah.
You went to study with Jerome.
In 98, really, that's when I moved east. I worked with Jerome Hines. From that point, I think it was about 4 years, maybe. I worked with him for. And my Met debut came in 2000.
Cenerentola. And I met you in 98.
In 98, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you studied with Jerome, you had him for how long?
Like 3 years.
3 years. And after that, you started traveling.
I kind of did it on my own for a good while. I felt like I gained a lot of foundation from his teaching, and then as time went on, I started doing roles with maybe some more baritonal, higher passaggios and things like that. And I went at that point in time to sort of negotiate that change in technique, or at least to change in repertoire. I started working with Armin Boyajian, who's basically a real strength in that he knows how to kind of put all the registers together, and especially smoothing out the passaggio. And so I worked with him pretty comprehensively, just on technique and no repertoire, for about 6 months.
Do you notice a change in your voice, a constant change? Do you notice it's going higher, it's going lower, it's maintaining, but the quality is diverse? What are the changes you're noticing with age?
Yeah, I'd say in the last 3 or 4 years, more space comes into the voice. There's always a little bit more size each year, and but the challenge there is that with the space and almost a deepening of the voice, that one still creates the height in the voice. In other words, that there's always the sense of the top range kind of being there, and and retaining the stretch between the bottom and the top range, and keeping that kind of thread always energized up to the very top. Because as I'm noticing, as I'm getting older, the voice wants to settle low, but there's no reason that it has to sort of stay in that place. It lives in a lot of places, but I think the best remedy for that is just really varying the repertoire. keeping it very, in other words, creating a lot of flexibility in the voice. You know, were I to just go and sing real basso or profondo kind of stuff all year, then it would be more of a challenge to kind of keep the height in the voice. So I'd like to do different kinds of repertoire, different range, and especially different kinds of roles, because whether consciously or not, one does color their own voice to suit a character.
Which brings me to one of the questions I will start asking, mixing the questions with my students. As a bass baritone, mm-hmm. you know, lower register, my life was, oh, you are too young to sing that rep. Mm-hmm. And then, oh no, you are too old to sing that rep. I wasn't never in the right age to sing that repertoire. Yeah. How was your life? How did you find for a young bass baritone, young bass, what type of repertoire you're going to look for?
You know, I think one has to start from, okay, when, say, after your first year of training, granted you have a great teacher like you to really bring, find the true range of a voice, young developing voice, you then need to take, at that point, ask the question about what's the repertoire this voice is really destined for. And I think it's fair enough, you know, if you're dealing with a Verdi bass, a future Verdi bass, there's no reason you can't work on Il Lacerato Spirito, because if you don't get some kind of stylistic idea of what that repertoire is, and not even just the style, but the physical approach to the voice in that repertoire, if you don't plant the seed somewhere early on, then later on it's a lot of backtracking in a way. You have to create a feeling in the voice, what that sensation is of doing long cantabile kind of phrases, and yeah. And really not being afraid to use the core of the voice. And I mean, we I think in the last 20, 30 years, this kind of more academic caution has been put into teaching younger voices that are destined for bigger repertoire. They, no, don't do it. And it goes too far. I think it goes too far. Jerome Hines learned, I think, 8 Verdi roles by the time he was 23. And so he already knew kind of where he was going with it. He was a very unusual case because he sang all that stuff in his 20s too. But I think he was very blessed with a very open-throated instrument that was able to house a lot of sound. But he ran into his own challenges because of that later on. But I think there is a comfortable medium where you work on what's happening now in the voice, but you remind the voice from time to time where it's going. So you keep the repertoire, the ratio of the repertoire, in such a way that it sort of matches up with that.
Let me ask you this, because once we enter kind of the opera world, we kind of let aside concert or lead or French mm-hmm. melody. Do you enjoy doing recitals? Is something
I love recitals, and I love concerts for the same reason, which is that rather than being in an opera house, which might be like the Met, or 2,000 to 4,000 seats, a lot of what the primary aspect of your performance is generating a lot of sound. But we forget that the text is so much a part of everything, not just, you know, the sound, but the color and the importance of the words in terms of the character. So I like going back to concert and recital when I can, for that very reason, because I like to go back, take out the set, take out the costumes, all that, and try to convey just as vivid an impression to the audience just through really getting back to painting the words and text. Because I mean, after all, that's really the starting point. If you're an actor or even a singer, really, it's finding the text, what it means to you,
and I just want to say for the record, because people will think that I'm telling you to say this, but it's interesting. In all the podcasts that I do, all the singers, all the directors, everybody says the same thing: the importance of the words, the importance of painting the words, and it's one of the hardest things to teach to the students.
Yeah.
They think if they do the sound, the meaning behind the word is not important.
Yeah.
And it is important.
Yeah.
It's what it moves people.
Yeah. The way I started at training with my father was actually to always, we did a lot of leader in the beginning, but to always have a visualization. You know, you visualize a story maybe going on, or an image to go with the poetry, and that you as long as you can keep that sort of happening in front of your imagination and even a focal point outside of you, then you can access some of the vocal colors just by instinct. You can build that instinct in there by doing that. You know, and so much of the poetry can spark those things in the imagination. You know, there's so much out there, and that's what I think really draws an audience in doing recitals, is that you're telling them a story or acting out a story, and it's right there. You're it's right in front of you. It's not enough just to stand there and make nice, pretty sounds and do a nice pianissimo, and you know, there's a point. It has to hit you on a visceral level,
yeah,
before it can hit the audience on one.
Which brings me to the next question: have you had any training as an actor?
I did some training when I was in Curtis with Rhoda Levine, you know, and it was only basically, you know, 2 years worth of training. And often I was gone from school. I was actually getting concert work and doing a lot of symphony gigs at the time, and my school was very understanding about it, which was great. I did work with her a lot on the idea of you know, building characters and also learning to really listen and respond in scenes to, you know, the other characters. And but when I got to San Francisco, I realized I didn't quite have the foundation that I wanted. So I did do a lot of, again, a lot of questions with directors. I had a lot of great directors who were very good at character building, and Lotfi Mansouri directed a lot of the productions that I was in, and that was one of his favorite things, was just really building the character up and creating what are his motivations and such and so on. But around that time, because I wanted to create more of my own foundation for acting, I read the Stanislavski books. There are three of them, and I read the first two, which are more technique-based. The other ones apply themselves to actual roles in operas, but an actor prepares and preparing a role. They're fantastic books. They're really fantastic books. You can read them over and over again, and I still think back to them in terms of when I'm developing a character, have I addressed all those elements that are highlighted in the different chapters of those books? You know, for instance, focus of attention, and you know, again, the relating to your colleagues and really responding, finding the neutral kind of relaxed physical place where you go back to in any scene, so that you can create contrast in your physicality and in your tempo rhythm, which is a huge thing in terms of how does this emotion affect the speed of your body, your gestures. What does it make happen in your mind, or what does it make happen in your body? And which can really often be translated into tempo rhythm. When you're doing operas, it's there in the score a lot of the time. The tempo rhythm of the character is built into the aria or the scene. And it's fun kind of plugging those Stanislavski concepts into a score or a role. So that I used that sort of as a basis for developing characters from that point onward. I love to get those books out and just reread them from time to time.
Good. Listen, take note. I've been talking to my students. I have a couple of questions that are interesting. Have you ever been in a production where it was a very frustrating situation by, you know, they missed the mark? And
yep.
if you believe, how did you feel? What did you do?
I was once in a Lucia production, which...
Don't say names, just in case.
I won't say.
Okay.
It was a modern concept, And this is very common. You know, it wasn't the first or the last time I was in a modern production, but what I could basically say with almost all these cases is that they missed the mark because the production really only had a concept. It was not a concept that was married to the story. And it becomes a distraction from the actual story. You know, if you have people dressed up like gangsters just because it looks cool or whatever, or you're creating an atmosphere, it's not enough. I think directors have, sometimes they get a concept that means a lot to them, but then they don't take it further and try to make it fit to the story or scenes.
Yeah, they simply get a concept.
They're just a concept, and it's that's it. And it's very frustrating because you're trying to fit yourself in to the story and the concept at the same time, and it's like trying to wear two different suits, and it's so common. It's so common that I don't know where directors go with that. I think they've just become obsessed with an image, in one image in their mind, or one dramatic idea, which isn't flexible.
How did you deal with that? How did you pass that to make it work for you? I mean,
you know, you have to make stubborn decisions sometimes, and not always agree with the director. And just try to make your own scenes work for you. You know, there are different ways around it, but I just treated the whole basic production as kind of wallpaper, if you will. It was just a look that I was having to have on top of a story that I was just going to stay true to, and play the scenes the way that I felt they should be played. That happens a lot. It happens a lot. And sometimes you can't come to an agreement with a director, and oftentimes not. But you get a split decision between how much... It's a push-pull thing. You know, you take some of what the director is saying, maybe enough that it makes them happy, and then you do your thing.
You put your stuff
in the much larger part of the ratio.
I will be jumping questions. What do you do if you're sick, if you don't feel 100%? Mm. Let's say you feel 60%. Mm. Do you perform? Do you cancel?
If I feel I have access to my range, my whole range, whether it's clean or clear or not, if I know all the notes are there, then I won't be afraid to do it. But it also depends on the repertoire. You know, for me, if I'm sick, then the top range is usually affected on some level. Because, I mean, if you have a sore throat or cold, there's inflammation up in, you know, in the nasal pharynx area. So that's where you have to kind of make your own judgment call. I believe that we can kind of develop our own inner voice in terms of telling us good or bad idea to sing tonight. But I think it makes sense. The first point that you start feeling that there is something wrong, I mean, aside from taking preventative medicines and such and so forth, to try to stay calm and really go into your how you're sensing everything inside, how it feels, give it a couple, you know, at least several hours really to think about it, if you can do so in a very calm, logical way. And then at that point, to really, depending, you know, if you have if you wake up the morning of the show, then you've got maybe 4 or 5 hours to make a decision. But it's good not to rush to a snap judgment, because the first reaction is a bit of panic.
Panic, yeah.
And it's good to just sort of try to take a step back and really try to look at the situation from the bigger picture. If I do sing tonight, how will I likely feel? Do I have enough time to recuperate before the next show? And I mean, this is exactly what I've been going through with Don Quixote.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to put this point.
And you know, then you get into the question of, okay, well, should I take, you know, the prednisone? Should I, you know, what sort of measures do I need to resort to, and what will be the repercussions of that? You know, and I could go into how I think about prednisone, you know, depending on the person, you know, what sort of repertoire you're trying to get yourself to sing.
But basically, the first thing also will be to go to an ENT.
Yeah, you go to an ENT.
Make sure what you have.
Yeah, if sometimes, you know, things are congestion, cold up top, but
yeah,
not in the cords.
Yourself.
But yeah, definitely have a very good ENT that you trust at that point in time. But And ask yourself, if I do sing, how much of my real voice is going to be coming out? How much of my real sound are they going to get? And, you know, how much might it affect my future in terms of who's out there, who's hearing it? But really just the first question is, you know, how am I feeling? Before you think of those parts of the picture where it affects more perspectives of career and such. It's not good to go to that place right off the bat.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're singing in the Metropolitan Opera and it's a telecast or something, it's a totally different situation.
Yeah.
If you're doing something that's going to be recorded, put on TV, or something that people will just now, I mean, on YouTube or something, then you do have to think in the bigger picture of what message am I sending to people? Because people who see those things are not going to say, oh, he had a cold. They say, oh, there's something wrong with
the voice
or whatever. That doesn't sound like him.
Now, let me ask you a couple of questions regarding the career. One of the big things that are changing today in the opera world, at least I think so, mm-hmm. is the information media. You have now the Metropolitan Opera doing live concerts in high definition mm-hmm. all over the place, access to million big screens TVs, internet. So it's changing also the look. I mean, you have a fantastic look. You're 6'4", you know, very fit. You go to the gym and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that inflicts because of this mm-hmm. media is that the voice, which used to be very important, and the way of singing, mm-hmm. which used to be very important 40, 30 years ago, now is also and level what is important, but there are other things that are important.
Yeah.
And people are getting frustrated about getting access to agents. What was your experience? How did you get an agent, or the agent get you?
Okay. My situation was a combination of a bit of luck and timing, and also, of course, you know, you go on talent too, but I was... Actually, I got my agent in 96, really right at the beginning of my Adler Fellowship. A friend of mine had heard me singing in the grand finals concert at Merrill, really liked what I did, and he called his agent and said, you have to hear this guy. So I was very fortunate for that in terms of timing and luck, really. But
does the friend get in at 10%?
But she came to hear me, and I did an audition for her. And, you know, she's a very, very big, important agent. And I got in with her, and it turned out to be a very good relationship. She really ended up having a very good understanding of artists at the beginning and the middle and later parts of their career and how that all works, because she had artists who have pretty much done their scope of careers with her. So she didn't sort of specialize in one level of artist. She understood how to foster the career path and not just kind of worry about how much money she could make.
Does she also advise you in the roles or the gigs that there are
At the beginning.
But she knew that I
had a lot of the right instincts and the perspective that I needed. I mean, you can't obviously leave it entirely up to your agent to know those things. But if the agent has a sense of, you know, whether you're taking too many risks or trying to go too far, too fast, mm-hmm. or vice versa, you know.
Or taking roles because you're desperate for money.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
That
so she's very good in a very balanced in that perspective.
Have you ever sung a role that it was disgusting, you just did for the money and ran?
Just for the money and ran.
Like La Cena Pronta in La Traviata?
I've done small roles, but they were, they came at the right times. They were part of the progress, and I knew when I wanted to try to leave certain things behind. So I stayed fairly true to myself artistically.
Fantastic.
The whole way through, and I try to keep all the projects artistically challenging or gratifying, or both. You know,
what do you find the good aspects about being an opera singer and the bad aspects of being an opera singer by you? I mean, mm-hmm. Mine. What is your the good at? What do you enjoy most and what do you hate most of being an opera singer?
I really enjoy the state of mind of performing. I like the fact that quite oftentimes when I'm on stage performing, it's sort of the one time in my life. I mean, not in my life, but in my typical life situation where I can actually live in the moment. And the more day-to-day mindset of being an opera singer is quite the opposite. It's always thinking far ahead. What do I do next? Was it good? Is it right? Where will I be in 2-3 years? Will I get enough time to see my family and that sort of thing? So, and you're learning repertoire for your next role, and you never, or I shouldn't say never, but it's very challenging to live in the moment and appreciate, you know, the good things around you on a daily basis when you're conditioned to think that way. Always the future, concern for the future, career, and that sort of thing. So it you find time sort of flies by really quick, and you miss things, or you don't fully experience the good things. Like for me, when I'm home with my family, it's very hard to kind of clue back into reality and present and just kind of really enjoy every moment that I'm home and not sort of stay in that mindset of, oh, what's next and how am I planning, you know, will I have my voice for this next thing, or will I learn this role, or am I taking too much, you know, there's all those thought processes can so easily take a hold of you and kind of get you spinning, and you know, and you're not enjoying life as it's happening. So that kind of tells you sort of the good and bad in a way. But back to the good, which is that I, as a performer, I really enjoy the feeling of being on stage and really experiencing the moments as they're happening. It's one of those times where you kind of get that. It's that the thing that I guess that a lot of people look for in meditation, you know, a very kind of aware, present sort of, it's almost like a spiritual thing on the good days.
Yes.
You know, of course, not every performance feels like that, but when it really clicks and when it really reminds you of what you love about it, that's sort of the way it feels. You know, it's an amazing kind of combination of drama and music and movement and emotion sort of all happening at the same time, but it makes you feel very alive in the moment.
I want to wrap up a little bit because we're taking a lot of time for you, I am afraid. I have all the day, but I want to ask you a little bit about your favorite singers. Mm. What are your favorite singers? Which roles you heard them? What inspires you? What did you listen?
I'd say my favorite singer is George London. And, you know, the sound is just incredible. It's a very ideal masculine sound, you know, and the very, very great technique mixed with a very animalistic approach. It's just, you can't listen to him and not feel something. It's just impossible. It's so powerful and so real, the way he sings, you know, and renders the characters. His Scarpia is just amazing. The recording of Boris Godunov is just astounding, and it's Flying Dutchman is amazing. I mean, it's all, I love to listen to that voice, all, you know, I could listen to it all the time. But really, as a singer-actor, I think he was just a great example of a real singer-actor. I mean, I think, I've seen a few things on YouTube of him, but there's a video of him singing Scarpia,
which is amazing,
which is great.
I never hear such a slow tempo in the Te Deum, and he pulled it off.
I
cannot even sing half a phrase.
Siepi for a very different reason, which is that, you know, this was a real classic sort of bel canto basso sound, you know, always very soft and velvety and never pushed, and just a great legato, and you know, that's a mezza voce that is something that I think most basses are always trying to find, is a color there.
In general, singers that cannot be basses, maybe tenors, which one touch your heart? Which one really speaks to you? Not only by technique, but, you know, something that has something special to you.
In terms of other singers too?
Yeah.
I'd say, and in my mind, I'm always listening to people in that era of those guys. And the other one that just always kind of reminds me of the sort of cathartic aspect of opera, and what it just kind of makes you get outside of your body. And it's Corelli. Yeah. I'd say Corelli is one of those. You know, you can kind of hear that he was terrified all the time when he sings. But there's something incredibly, I don't know, it's just, again, it's like the thing that I love about opera is just the visceral side of, and the theatrical side of things. And when you hear those voices, you don't even have to see them on stage. It's something very dramatic going on, you know. And yeah, they really do.
Well, I want to thank you. I also want to ask you if eventually you would like to come and do a masterclass for us.
I would love to.
We can arrange that.
Yes,
for
I want to.
Nothing of money.
Free.
But free.
Completely free.
No, but for something
I would love to. I love doing masterclasses.
And we have a lot of voices, not only bass baritones, that would love to have you there.
Yeah.
And maybe we can arrange something
that
next year.
That would be great.
Bring you, and we give you water and tea, and I take you to coffee after, and you can teach us. It will be a great experience. Thank you so much, and I love doing this Sancho with you, and hopefully we'll bring much more in the future. Thank you.